Science considers bears to be solitary animals, but they have amazingly complex social relationships. Each individual's behaviour is controlled by all of the individuals with whom it shares resources, and shifting hierarchies form within families, among males, and among unrelated bears at any place that bears congregate to feed. They communicate through facial expressions, ear movements, body posture, and scent cues. They also maintain their relationships through judgment and punishment, behaviours thought to exist only in humans. Bears, in short, are part of sophisticated societies that we are only beginning to understand. There is a place in the remote northwoods of Minnesota, North America. It's located near the town of Orr, population approximately 300. Outside this town is an area where normal rules are put to one side. It's a place where humans and wildlife meet. It's a special place, wholly unique and not without its controversies. This is the Vince Chuti Wildlife Sanctuary, run by the American Bear Association, ABA for short. The ABA is dedicated to promoting a better understanding of black bears and all wildlife through education, observation, and experience. I'm your host, Philip Stubley, and welcome to the Bear Den. At the sanctuary, there is the building known as the Cook Shack, also known as Biscuits Cafe, named after a bear. Shock horror. It is here where volunteers and staff relax, prepare and eat their meals. It's located at the heart of the sanctuary in the feeding area, colloquially known as the Magic Circle. And it has acquired all sorts of bits and bobs that people have donated or left behind, including an eclectic library. And you betcha there's a guide to speaking Minnesotan, which I've used to full effect, sidling up to the local barflies and asking, "How about them twins? Oofda." Another of the more interesting books is Row Away from the Rocks by George Henry. He was a long-term visitor to the sanctuary, along with his wife Kay, for over a decade. Every Wednesday, they prepared or delivered delicious meals to feed hungry volunteers. Now that's just a snapshot of George's colourful life. He piloted a B-24 bomber in World War II, was a respected photographer, and a world-renowned river guide of Whitewater Rapids, guiding, among other people, Robert and Ted Kennedy in the 1960s. His book is filled with anecdotes and photographs aplenty. George lived a life, only passing away relatively recently on his 101st birthday in January 2024. So, it's September 2016. I was at the sanctuary, at a bit of a loose end, so pulled a bear-related book off the shelf and began idly flicking through. And this is where the quote that preceded the credits comes from. I soon found I couldn't put this book down. In this episode, I want to talk about this book and the author, Out on a Limb by Benjamin Kilham. This book connected with me straight away, as I found a lot of what Benjamin Kilham was describing was applicable to the Vince Chuti Wildlife Sanctuary. I appreciate this is quite a long episode and there is a lot of information to take in, so if you choose to pause this halfway through and revisit later, I get it. Also, I mean, I don't know Benjamin Kilham outside of the book, really. I think it would be pretty cool to meet him, and I can imagine some of the stuff is not everyone's cup of tea, but I do think the ideas presented here are very interesting and worthy of discussion. This is my interpretation, and I welcome any other views or takes on this. So, the book Out on a Limb details bear communications, vocalizations, body language, and other behaviours, and how its author, Benjamin Kilham, learned to read them. The book is also a wealth of knowledge on bear biology and is a must for anyone interested in black bear behaviour. It is littered with charming anecdotes and offers a fascinating perspective and understanding on bears gained directly from observation and experience. I do like how that ties neatly into the ABA mission statement of promoting a better understanding of black bears through observation and experience. There are also ideas which challenge conventional wisdom on bears, and Benjamin Kilham's methods are somewhat unorthodox, but have produced thought-provoking insights. So I'm going to give you a brief outline of who Benjamin Kilham is, his work, a bear named Squirty, and focus on a few key areas of bear behaviour, including family dynamics, communications, collaboration, and the social order of bears. And I will draw comparisons to the sanctuary as I go, and I hope you'll see them for yourself as well, and if and when you visit the sanctuary again, or for the first time, you'll be able to look out for certain bear behaviours yourselves. So prepare yourselves, we're going deep. Who is Benjamin Kilham, hereafter referred to as Ben? You know, my friend Ben. Ben lives in New Hampshire, USA. and has hand-raised hundreds of orphan black bear cubs and reintroduced them into the wild by walking with them in the forest, giving them the opportunity to gradually learn how to find food and identify the smells of other bears. When those cubs gained independence, they still saw Ben as their quote-unquote mother, and this allowed him to revisit the woods and observe them. Here, he saw complex social interactions and learned about both the orphans and wild bears in his study area. For over 20 years, he has been interacting with wild black bears as a state-licensed bear researcher. It wasn't an easy path, as severe dyslexia closed the doors to an academic career early in life, but he has turned this into an asset. He may have had to overcome his difficulty in reading books, but when it came to reading nature, he was extremely literate. He learned the value of alternative ways of education and experiencing the world. His ability to read emotions in detail and think in pictures rather than words helped him understand bear thoughts. Over the years, Ben found the best form of data gathering was with his eyes. He has amassed a wealth of new information about black bears and how they communicate, socialize, and share resources. Bears form alliances with strangers, make calculations about costs and benefits, lay down rules, and punish those who break them. They trade based on a clear system of reciprocity. Lambert Clearing, as Ben calls it, is a small clearing at the site of an abandoned farmstead. It's here that Ben opens the book, where he is meeting Squirty, a bear you're going to hear a lot about. She was orphaned at 7 weeks old, and Ben raised and released her, along with two siblings, back to the wild. He goes on to describe Squirty chasing off a male bear that had also visited the clearing. This male bear had broken the rules and come close to a mother and cub, and she immediately chased him off. Ben knew that he was in no danger, as she approved of his presence there. She would let him know if she wanted him to leave. Immediately, I thought of several such encounters just like this we've witnessed at the sanctuary feeding area. Most evenings, Ben meets Squirty in this clearing and they are often joined by other bears who live and feed in the area at Squirty's discretion. This is her home range after all. Some of the visitors are her descendants, while others are unrelated. Sound familiar? For Ben, his rehabilitation work is a family affair, as his wife Debbie and sister Phoebe also help raise the orphaned cubs. They learned to bottle feed cubs, wean the cubs onto solid foods, and clean up after them. They then manage the bear's transition from home to outdoor enclosure and finally back to the wild. The reasons that orphan cubs end up in human care vary from mothers abandoning cubs due to food shortage or when their dens are disturbed, to a mother being killed by a run-in with car or firearm. Newborn cubs are bottle-fed around the clock, suckle on earlobes and fingers, and can be equated to raising a human toddler. They cry out when they're hungry and are sweet and content when satisfied. To raise the cubs, Ben studied scientific literature, and back in the 1990s, when he first started, there wasn't much written about this. One study was written by a scientist, who had released some 6-month-old cubs back to the wild, and found they were still alive 3 months later. So they concluded that orphan black bear cubs older than 5 months could survive by themselves in the wild. It's quite shocking to read when nowadays it's drilled into my head how black bear cubs spend 18 months with their mothers. That study seems to be a huge exception. This is when Ben decided to conduct his own study, learning from the bears he raised, and one in particular, named Squirty. Squirty arrived in Ben Kilham's life in March 1996. Squirty's mother's den had been disturbed, and she scarpered, leaving 3 cubs behind, 2 females and 1 male, who ended up under Ben's auspices. The 7-week-old cubs were bottle-fed 3 to 4 times a day and adjusted to life in a new den, in this case, a large basket in the guest bedroom. They eventually leveled up and were kept in the basement, where they had a climbing structure made from ash logs to keep them from tearing up the structural beams. Ben walked through the woods with the cubs through spring and summer, helping them explore their natural environment and observe them as they learned to be wild bears. As winter approached, the cubs fattened up for their long nap and hibernated in a specially built den. By next June, the male cub, Boy, and Squirty's sister, Curls, left the area. Squirty stayed close by. By fitting a radio collar onto her, Ben was able to track her movements, see where she denned, and reunite with her each spring. He watched on as she raised over 12 cubs, establish a home range, become the dominant bear in it, and form cooperative relationships with unrelated wild bears. Ben's mother-daughter relationship with Squirty had drawn him into the heart of the bear's world and proven key to his understanding of black bear behaviour. This relationship with Squirty was built up and developed over the 15 months that Ben was her surrogate mother. He often gets asked, if you raise these bears, are they going to like all people? His answer is that they have an initial curiosity about strange people they meet in their transition to the wild, but they don't get the same signals from strangers as they did from Ben, and the interest quickly passes. They also learn quickly not to trust strange bears, like a human child who learns to be wary of strangers as they get older. Squirty's offspring did not treat Ben the way Squirty does. There is a level of trust, but they treated him with caution and were clearly intimidated by his presence. In the end, though, Squirty and her cubs seemed to operate the same as wild bears. For bears, observation is the only method for amassing new knowledge. Images become a means of storing information. The right choice can lead to glory, while the wrong choice can be fatal. Hierarchies of dominance develop based on age, family status, physical size, and personality, as well as over food, security, and the right to mate. These issues are dealt with on an individual basis and maintained with various forms of communication. Scent and body language are the primary ways to communicate. Bears are easy to read once you spend large amounts of time with them. Frowns are frowns, smiles are smiles. Squirty's first set of cubs, Snowy and Bert, were born in January 1999, 2 years after she had fully returned to the wild. It's worth mentioning that's Bert with an E, as there are a couple of Berts that crop up. During this year, she pushed the boundaries of her home range. Contests with neighbouring females were frequent. Ben ascertained these fights were over a summer food supply in a recently logged 100-acre lot that was now in berry stage. These territorial scuffs were not by chance. Bears resource guard their home ranges after all. They stand their ground to defend them, but with these repeated encounters, their aggression would lessen over time, and they would slowly build alliances. These encounters were stepping stones to friendship. Limits of interactions are established, and boundaries are set. These encounters happen, it's suspected, during what's called the fall shuffle. This is late in the year when bears travel short and long distances to feed on abundant surplus foods, when the food supplies in their home ranges have waned. We believe that we see this long-distance travel at the sanctuary as well, as we have some bears that only arrive in the August and September period, leaving their home range to feed on an abundant supplemental food supply. Ben has tracked both his own bears and wild unrelated individuals working with the New Hampshire Fish and Game Department. The department wanted to find out more about cub survival to better project bear populations in the state. 10 female bears were collared in Ben's study area of 60 square miles. This included a mix of Squirty's relatives and females unrelated to Squirty. Tracking these bears revealed much about the way bears define and defend their turf, interact with family members, competitors, and mates, and most surprising, negotiate the social contracts that define their lives. Female bears, with cubs, carve out a home range of high quality to support the family. It's advantageous for a mother to have daughters who fill and expand the existing home ranges. So if conditions allow it, mothers make room for female offspring and build a greater home range. Squirty has also continually expanded her home range through contests with other females. The core areas of the typical female home range is 3 to 5 square miles, with some overlap into neighbouring female home ranges. Home range sizes vary from place to place across the country. They depend entirely on the quality of the habitat. More food in a smaller space means a bear doesn't need to carve out as large a territory. A sparser food supply, on the other hand, means a bear needs more territory to survive. Single sub-adult males, generally under 8 years old, are chased out of female territories, but appear to access surplus foods by forming groups of friends and overpowering resident females. Adult males are basically asked by females to leave and not compete with them for food and other resources, such as space, cover, and water. The fact that males comply signifies a degree of female choice in mating. Breeding males are much larger than females and could easily stay in a female's turf and compete with her for food, but they choose not to because of the repercussions on the mating front. Overlapping these female home ranges will be the ranges of several breeding males. one dominant male may mate with multiple females in his breeding area, introducing another level of relatedness among bears in any given territory. Males are more transient, so population of males in any given area changes over time. Bears live in a world of feast and famine. One summer may see a huge raspberry crop, the next summer there may be none. The amount and reliability of their food supply determines not only their survival, but also the survival of the next generation. In good food years, dominant / subdominant females can raise cubs, but in bad years or places with a lot of competition, a female may reach the age of 5 or 6 before raising her first set of cubs. Because food supplies vary so much in space and time, no one bear or even group of bears could defend a territory large enough to provide all the food required for survival and reproduction. To secure the food they need, Squirty and other female bears maintain overlapping home ranges and develop long-term cooperative relationships with other individual bears. Many of the females Squirty and her bear clan are now friendly with are the same ones they once competed for resources over. The oldest bear in Ben's study was called Moose. She was tagged and collared in 2004. Her home range is dominated by beech trees, which produce nuts, but are unreliable. Squirty's home range is largely made up of red oak stands, which produce abundant nut crops only once every 4 to 5 years. One day in 2005, Ben visited Squirty in her clearing and put 2 small piles of corn on the ground some distance apart. Squirty began feeding on one of the piles. Moose then came down the hill and passed about 10 feet behind Squirty and began feeding at the second pile. Squirty just ignored Moose, this unrelated bear. Ben noted that Moose's trees didn't produce much that year while Squirty's had been bountiful. It was then that he realised Moose had a cooperative relationship with Squirty and Squirty's clan of relatives. Initially, Moose appeared at the clearing without cubs, most often visiting when she needed to fatten up to give birth. Now, when she was more comfortable with her relationship with Squirty, she routinely brought her cubs to the clearing in years when there were plenty of acorns, but rarely in years when the beech trees in her home range were productive. With rare exceptions, Squirty willingly shares extra food. It's not just Moose, though. One year, during a natural widespread shortage of food, Squirty shared her resources at the clearing with at least 20 other bears, many of them strangers. Likewise, Squirty's radio collar showed that she fed in other bears' territories. New relationships and resource sharing continue to develop. These relationships are mutually beneficial. Since bears' food sources are unevenly distributed across the landscape for most of the year, one bear can enjoy a surplus in their home range while another suffers famine. The situation may be the opposite the following year. Sharing, therefore, is a matter of survival. They develop and enforce a complex array of these social contracts. The more alliances a bear forms with its neighbours, it appears, the more likely it will secure food in times of shortage. The social contracts minimise the amount of energy expended in aggressive interactions while gaining access to surplus foods. Females forge reciprocal relationships with both related and unrelated females. Coalitions of unrelated males also form to access surplus food in female home ranges. Males are able to travel far and wide, learning of new food sources or possibly cultural advances. When food is scarce in one bear's home range, the bear can travel or follow others to learn the location of surplus foods. For a bear, navigating these social waters must start at a young age. Each cub needs to develop a personal coalition of other bears willing to share the resources required to survive and reproduce. Complex networks of friends, social relationships, and communication become the fabric of a greater society. Squirty made sure to remind bears that she was in charge using a stiff-legged walk and marked the ground with drops of urine. This is a yearly routine as hierarchies must be established and subordinate females will recognise her scent. The Vinschuti sanctuary equivalent would be the dominant male, Cheeky, who we see practice this every year as well. Benjamin was able to collar a male bear named Bert in 2008. That's Bert with a U. Bert was 10 years old and was a preferred mate for Squirty. During the mid-May mating season, Bert travelled around like a gentleman on tour, sometimes travelling 10 to 15 miles a day, and he mated with two females and made himself available to at least three others. Ben would get reports of a mother and her cub near people's houses to feed from bird feeders that should not have been there. It wasn't a mother and cub, though. As it turned out, it was Bert with a much smaller mate. The female appeared to be taking advantage of Bert's larger size and had him as a bodyguard while foraging in potentially risky places. There was a similar example that we saw of this behaviour at the sanctuary back in 2015, with a 30-year-old female named Sarah. She arrived moving slowly. We could see that both of her eyes were milky white with cataracts. A male offspring of hers named George would often sit next to her while she ate. He didn't take any of her food and kept other bears away from her. To us, this indicated a degree of empathy on his part. Mating behaviours are fascinating. When Squirty is ready to mate, she disperses her cubs and ventures around her home range advertising her condition to prospective mates. Courtship behaviour involves lots of full back rubs on trees and eating together. Males don't generally breed until they are around 8 years old. They are sexually mature at age 2, but larger males essentially block them. Only the largest 10 to 15% of males successfully mate with mature females. Subadult males travel around with subadult females. These younger females are of no interest to the older males as they lack a home range and are unable to fatten up enough before hibernation. Without enough fat reserves, she will just go back into estrus next season. So even if she does have cubs, they may starve or she abandons them when her mate turns up. It's possible the male bear may also kill the cubs. He has no interest in cubs who are not going to survive or who aren't his. Saying that, scientists have no real solid evidence that infanticide is sexually strategic though. You can also listen to my interview with ABA president Steph Horner to hear some different examples of adult male bears and cub interactions. Bears need to cooperate often and interact with non-relatives and strangers to manage their food sharing and open society. Think of it this way. If you're going out and interacting with strangers each day, as bears often are, you've got to be able to communicate. And bears seem to have two basic ways of communicating, with scent, which includes both leaving it and interpreting it, and without scent, which includes vocalization, facial expressions, intentional expressions, body language, symbolic communication, pantomime, and ear expressions. As an aside, recent studies of one of the other bear species, sun bears, have described how they imitate each other's faces during play, something only thought to be practiced by humans and gorillas before. Everywhere a black bear goes, it unintentionally leaves a scent that can be identified and followed by another bear. This allows bears to follow each other to find surplus food and track down any freeloaders who are breaking the rules. Olfactory communication in bears is a mix of transparency and deliberate communication, like modern human language. When bears scent mark, other bears remarkably can tell who left it, the gender of the bear, the mood, the relatedness, and their social standing. These scents can be targeted at specific individuals. For example, Squirty would leave fresh scat in areas so Ben would know that she was in the vicinity. Interestingly, well, to me at least, when bears are really scared, they release scent from their anal glands. These, like the anal glands of domestic dogs, put out an unpleasant and powerful odour. This odour can alert other bears to danger, kind of like how ravens make loud calls to warn other ravens of danger. When bears that are familiar with one another reunite after some time apart, they greet each other with a nose-to-nose or mouth-to-mouth kiss, or with open mouths. Cubs with siblings have a fairly ritualized form of play that starts with them facing off on the ground with open mouths and quickly becomes a bipedal wrestle, reminiscent of a waltz or perhaps a sumo wrestling session. Some biologists refer to this as mock fighting because of the aggressive looks on the bear faces, but it is done in complete silence and Ben has found it to be a mechanism of soliciting friendship and food sharing. Using a remote video camera baited with a pile of corn, Ben filmed this same interaction in adult wild bears. One male was feeding when a second large male came into view and circled him. Honoring his position, the second male came back towards the first and opened his mouth. Then the first bear, too, opened his mouth to share breath in a ritualized way, which may allow bears to identify each other at close distances. Then they stood up and wrestled, before lying down and sharing that small amount of corn. wrestling is often a way to bond and build trust. Again, this is a common sight at the sanctuary as well. Watching this mouthing behaviour led Ben to make a discovery of his own. He began recording this mouthing behaviour. When mouthing vegetation or objects, like frogs or mushrooms, bears seemed to be able to discriminate between what was edible and what wasn't, leading Ben to question whether that ability was aided by some special anatomical feature. Warning, things are about to get quite anatomical here. I'm no expert, but bear with me. After dissecting a bear that was a victim of roadkill, which was supplied by a New Hampshire conservation officer, Ben found a fleshy organ about the size of a jelly bean in a pocket in the vomer, a V-shaped bone that runs under the centerline of the nose and above the palate. Many mammals have a vomeronasal organ, aka a Jacobson organ, that lets them lift scent with their saliva to detect pheromones and other chemical messengers. But such an organ had not been documented in bears. Ben studied a bear skull and found that the bone between the bottom of the vomer's pocket and the roof of the mouth was translucent, with an opening along the suture where the plates of the bone come together. He studied other animals and consulted experts, but found nothing that had any resemblance to what he had found in bears. After writing to Charles Wysocki at the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia, Ben was invited to present his findings along with a sample of this strange organ. It turned out no such organ had been previously described in bears. It was named the Kilham organ. Ben had watched bears opening and closing their mouths as they received long-distance airborne scent from other bears and tested it with their Kilham organ. They would false charge or chomp if it was a scent from a bear they didn't know or trust, and would act indifferent or smile if it was a relative, friend or mate. Bears, except pandas, are the only known mammal with the Kilham organ, which seems to specialise in the identification of light or aromatic molecules. Mammals that lack this organ all have long-range vocalisations. Dogs bark, wolves howl, pandas and chimpanzees call for mates, and so on. But bears are silent on the long-distance frontier. Contrary to popular belief in New England, they do not hoot. I'm not sure why that is a thing. All this stemmed from Ben's observations leading to collaboration, reading, and research. Bears' behaviour is interrelated and has been designed by a step-by-step process of evolution. We read each other's expressions, gauge moods, and pick up on social cues. We also depend on context. The same applies to bears. Vocalizations and actions are delivered with different intensity at different times, and have different meanings depending on the context. Bears' facial expressions are harder to read, but they do have them. For instance, by reading a bear's facial expression, or the way their ears are cocked, it can be telling you that you've overstayed your welcome. The way bears communicate with their ears is similar to the way horses and deer do. Bears have both functional and emotional ear movements. Some ear movements simply allow them to stay alert to sound. When they are eating, for instance, the very act of chewing creates noise, which compromises their ability to pick up other sounds around them. So, they rotate their ears outwards, with the openings opposite each other, for maximum coverage and picking up sounds. While investigating sounds, or when alerted to scent, they rotate their ears forward in the direction of the sounds or smell. When stalking another bear, their ears are also cocked forward. Other ear positions act out an emotional sign language. Pinned back if they're approaching aggressively or attacking, irritated ears are half cocked, and a cautious bear may have one ear forward and one ear backward. Bears use body language, employing gestures, actions, and emotions to communicate. This indicates intentional communication on their part, and understanding that the recipient knows what is being said. Another section of the book that I enjoyed reading and nodding along with covered the various examples of bear vocal sounds. Bears have a repertoire of vocal sounds to get their point across. Male bears use a loud gulping sound to get female bears to go with them during mating season. Female bears use a similar gulp vocalization coupled with various body movements to guide their cubs safely through life. When a mother perceives danger, she will make a gulp vocalization to signal her cubs to group tightly and follow her. If she gulps walking toward a safety tree, she wants them to go up it. If she gulps at the base of a tree, she wants them to come down. And when she walks away and gulps, it is a signal for them to come down and follow. If there is danger, there will be an urgency in her gulp and her actions. She may spin around gulping and run for the tree she wants her cubs to go up. It could be argued that this linkage between the gulp vocalization and body language constitutes an early form of syntax, the way words are put together to form phrases. It is likely that basic bear vocalizations are instinctive, but their use may be learned. Some vocalizations are clearly with the cubs from birth, something Ben learned from raising orphans and confirmed when observing them in the wild. When they are nursing or suckling, they emit a rhythmic droning sound of contentment. When falling asleep or during quiet times of joy, cubs will make a sound like a pigeon's coo. Their distress calls sound like, apologies in advance for this, meow, meow. And if they are in emotional distress, they'll emit an undulating moan. When the cub expresses recognition, they let out a series of soft moans. I've also heard cubs use different types of moans to broadcast hunger, nervousness, and irritation. They gulp when nervous, they vocalise an when wrestling to limit biting or to call an end to the ruckus, and they'll sound out a mew mew to solicit the company of a nearby bear. When one bear walks directly at another, it is a sign of dominance or aggression. A bear needs a modifier to signal when the approach is non-confrontational. Squirty greets Ben with a soft vocalization to signal friendly intent. They use a similar vocalization when pleading for reconciliation after they issue a moralistic punishment. Moralistic punishment is, in other words, punishment meant to enforce codes of conduct but doesn't aim to permanently alienate the recipient. It's noteworthy that black bear vocalizations are similar, but the key differences are that one is done with the mouth open and the other with the mouth shut, and they have opposing meanings. The guttural, open-mouthed is negative, the human equivalent of a chewing out, and the soft is positive, being either non-threatening or conciliatory. My relationship with Squirty and my understanding of how she manages her social relationships has left me with a much better understanding of my own world and the many layers of social complexity that I deal with on a daily basis. She has demonstrated the ability to make a contract with me and hold me to it, to selectively manage her relationships with her relatives and share surplus foods with unrelated bears, and to manage her sharing relationships with judgment and punishment. She goes to great lengths to make sure that she has primary access to food within her home range. But her ability to share also ensures that she has access to surplus food in a stranger's home range in a time of shortage. Her actions benefit her as an individual, but they also help her kin and stranger in time of need. Squirty has established her own rules, meaning every other bear has the ability to establish its own rules and relationships with other bears. A social code of cooperation that favours relatives and includes strangers is hammered out between individuals with expectations. Enforcement is easier among relatives because of the trust fostered in a family environment. If punishment is too harsh, it can be corrected with reconciliation. When their densities increase or when they congregate at a concentrated food source, hierarchies emerge as social interactions multiply. Increased densities lead to an increase in sharing and in the need to manage fairness and to punish those who are perceived to cheat. Like Squirty, we are all born with the need to survive and pass on our genes. And also, like Squirty, we were born to perceive, judge, and act on judgments about the individuals with whom we cooperate. Fairness is about what we perceive as fair, not necessarily what is fair. Our brain, like Squirty's, receives information and draws conclusions from the information. In Squirty's world, the information received comes only in the form of first-hand experiences and observations of other actions. She acts on this information based on her expectations of another individual's behaviour, which is based on a contract of cooperation, or in other words, a social contract. Without one, there would be no rules. For example, Squirty's daughters can share her home range as long as they obey Squirty's rules. If Squirty perceives a breach of contract, she will extract an appropriate punishment. Each bear has its own moral sense. It is both judge and jury. Rules become norms when environmental conditions cause a group of animals to come up with the same set of rules. This works in Squirty's world because each bear has social status and cooperates with a limited number of individuals. Somewhere between 5 and 25 bears, I have observed. The same idea still functions in our world. Each of us has our own rules, and norms change with changes in the cultural environment. The Bears have created a system of punishment that is proportionate to the misconduct. Ben has never observed or received any aggressive action from a bear that lacked a clear motive. Bears have developed a finely tuned communication system in which the subordinate individual can read the intentions and emotions of their dominants and avoid their wrath. Ben has been bitten for infractions or violation of an individual bear's rules, such as Squirty. Bites Ben receives are largely due to the fact that the bears who bite him treat him like a bear. Death, as in the human world, is the ultimate penalty, but this is rarely used. Humans have possibly suffered severe injuries or death when they have unwittingly broken these bears' rules. Choreographed aggression remains the preferred form of punishment among bears, and they begin to hone their skills at righting wrongs early on. The earliest scruff Ben witnessed was among his cubs when one sensed that another was getting more than a fair share of toys. With an angry roar and swept back ears, the offended cub tore into the other and a well-focused brawl erupted. All of their strikes were aimed at the head, neck and shoulders, all areas that had deep muscle or only shallow, fleshy overbone, limiting the injuries they could inflict. Cubs also encounter aggression in the form of false charges from their mother. These are disciplinary actions that keep their behaviour manageable and to protect them as they learn to navigate the world around them. Females continue to use aggression to reinforce rules and boundaries. Much like Jane Goodall, Benjamin Kilham's research is primarily qualitative, based upon hundreds of diverse observations, meaning they are difficult to publish in scientific journals. But Ben is invited to lecture at universities and present at conferences. He has even been called upon to help the Chinese reintroduce pandas into the wild, based directly on his experiences rehabilitating black bears. He is also the subject of several documentaries. His first book, titled Among the Bears, is used by high school and college teachers to get students interested in modern science as well. I confess I haven't read that one, but I definitely should. Finally, human success, like bear social behaviour, grew out of our ability to access and share surplus resources in times of need outside conventional home ranges, and is still applicable today. Would you believe that is a brief whistle-stop exploration of the book? If you want to drill deeper into this and read more about Benjamin Kilham's work, I thoroughly recommend it. Now, can we apply what we've heard to the sanctuary? Many of the examples Ben lists, such as bears initiating play, mothers running male bears off, non-vocal and vocal interactions, are all things we observe at the sanctuary. We see the whole tapestry of bear activity throughout the season, from mating behaviours, mothers sending cubs up trees, to chasing off yearlings who need to learn they're on their own. A mixture of related and non-related bears gather here every year, albeit quite a few more than the amount Ben describes, but the principle remains the same. In years of natural food abundance, we see less bear visitors, and in years where there is a lack of natural forage, we generally have more visitors. The bears that visit the feeding area, known as the Magic Circle, have established a coalition of their own with a set of rules and hierarchies that are established and re-established every year. Dominant males occupy the meadow area, while subadults and mothers with cubs stick to the surrounding trees. The bears share this resource as they know there is enough for all. It makes no sense for them to expend energy fighting over resources here and instead focus on collaboration. We see mothers visit alone at first to scope the area out and then return with their cubs. We've even seen some mothers drop off their cubs with other mothers, possibly relatives, who effectively babysit them while the mother goes off to forage for food, regain her strength and, frankly, get some me time probably. If there is an infraction, individuals enforce punishments. These are usually for minor things, such as two bears grumbling at each other over one food site and establishing their social status. One bear will submit and make way for the other. There are cases where individuals take a dislike to one another and seem to have a long-running feud, and they have to adapt and avoid one another if they want to stick around. New bears that visit are taught the rules by older bears, and we witness newcomers learning and testing their limits. Towards the end of the season, we see younger males, or yearlings, form small groups and hang around the magic circle while they learn how to navigate this social dynamic. They often learn the rules by unintentionally breaking them. if a bear breaches a code of conduct, it is punished, but the punishment fits the crime. A mother emitting a guttural to a male that strays too close to her and her cubs, for instance. As long as the male backs off, the situation doesn't escalate. Other bears approach food sites in a more friendly manner, open-mouthed and engaging in bipedal wrestling. The woodchip pile in the centre of the meadow makes an ideal wrestling ring. In much the same way, we humans learn to adhere to rules within the magic circle and respect boundaries. By entering the feeding area, we agree to the sanctuary's unique social code of conduct. For the most part, we humans intimidate the bears, but our presence is permissive. We are hands-off and don't get involved in any bear disputes or discussions. The bears allow us to walk among them and observe them as long as there is food supplied. That is the quid pro quo social contract that we have entered into with the bears, and this enables us to provide educational opportunities for visitors and listeners alike. This dynamic allows us to demonstrate coexistence and respect between species. These rules only hold true while we are in the feeding area and its environmental conditions. As soon as we and the bears leave the magic circle, the quote-unquote normal rules of human-bear interaction reapply, with we humans using negative conditioning techniques if we see a bear, and strictly no feeding. The bears, for their part, know that the magic circle is an area where they can share surplus resources and not outside of it. All this from idly just picking up a book from the shelf. That's my two cents on it. How about you? We'd love to hear your thoughts and if you have any book recommendations as well. Much of what Ben wrote about came to resonate with me even more over time. After spending some years in Borneo, Indonesia, raising orphaned sun bear cubs, some from a very young age, I found that I could relate to some of Ben's experiences. And I do want to cover that in a future episode. For now though, let's round things off by hearing from ABA volunteer Sarah Garris. She will introduce herself and talk about a bear she connected with, but also how the sanctuary came to influence her career path in life.
Hi, my name is Sarah. I am an elementary teacher in Oklahoma, and I've been volunteering at the Vince Schutte Wildlife Sanctuary for the past 10 years. I got an internship at the sanctuary right out of college. I had graduated from Oklahoma State University with a degree in zoology and had absolutely no clue what I wanted to do. This internship came up on a job board that I was looking at one day, and everything just seemed to fall into place. I applied, was accepted, and in just a couple of weeks, I had my car loaded up and was driving up north with absolutely no clue what I was in for. I remember the day that I got there. Pretty sure Philip and I arrived on the exact same day and actually got to ride down to the Magic Circle for the first time together. And it was truly just a magical experience seeing all of the wild bears in person. Words really cannot describe it. I spent that entire summer and fall living in the cabins and working, and I think that I can honestly say that those months transformed my life and my future. So, I fell in love with the place and continued to volunteer each summer, sometimes just for a month, sometimes just a few weeks, whatever ended up working out in my schedule. And over the years, I have fallen in love with many different bears, which, if you've ever been there to visit, I'm sure you understand. However, there is one bear that I really feel as though I have connected with, and his name is Cheeky. Cheeky was there my first year as an intern, and honestly, he kind of scared me a little bit. He was, and still is, one of the more dominant male bears at the sanctuary. He's, I'm pretty sure, 25 years old now, and he can look pretty rough and mean at times. He has a lot of battle scars on his face, and he walks with a limp. I've heard people compare him to a Sylvester Stallone-looking bear, and just about every bear knows to stay out of his way, especially if he's walking towards food. I have seen some younger, brave bears try to challenge him for food, but one bellow from him, and they typically take off in a different direction, usually pretty quickly. It's really cool to watch how most of the bears respect the hierarchy of who's more quote-unquote dominant. Even as he's getting up there in his years, he's still respected by most of the bears. Even though he's tough and he's big and he's mean-looking, and I was scared of him at first, Cheeky very quickly became my favorite bear, and he's kind of become my sounding board over the years. When I have a big life choice, such as a decision in my career path, I talk to him about it. I have spent many hours with him just talking while he's munching on peanuts or watermelon. And I always feel better about whatever it was I was talking to him about. He definitely knows more about me and my life than any person. So like I said before, the sanctuary transformed my future. When I graduated in 2014, I had absolutely no clue what I wanted to do with my life. One of the mission objectives for the sanctuary is to educate the public about black bears and the environment. And so as an intern, I got to do a lot of educating through conversations with visitors on the viewing platform. And I actually ended up having a lot of times that it was more conversations with like the children than the adults that visited. And I decided that first summer that education is what I wanted to do. So when the fall came and the bears all left, I went back home and went back to school to become a teacher. So now I've been teaching for 7 years, and I always go back to that summer when I think about the direction my life has gone. I absolutely love teaching. I can't imagine doing anything else. And I have the sanctuary and Cheeky to thank for that. And another bonus is that with a school schedule, I'm still able to go and volunteer every summer and be with the bears that helped start it all.
The Bear Den, the American Bear Association podcast, was written and presented by me, Philip Stubley. The music was composed by React Music and Simon Folwar. Thank you to everyone who has made this podcast possible, including Karen Hauserman, Bill Lee, Clarie Lee, Stephanie Horner, Donna Brzezinka, Ross Coyer, and Angie Page. You can find out more about the American Bear Association at www.americanbear.org. You can find Vinchuti Wildlife Sanctuary on Facebook and Instagram. You can ask questions and submit comments about the podcast to peacewi@americanbear.org. The ABA is a special circumstance. We do not condone feeding wild animals. If you enjoy this podcast, help support the ABA either by donating, becoming an ABA member, symbolically adopting a bear, or come visit the sanctuary during the season and say hello. And if you do enjoy this, please do us a favour. It'll barely take any of your time, I promise. On whatever platform you're listening to this on, please either follow us, click the bell for updates, notifications, please share with family and friends, and rate the podcast, as it all helps us grow and is greatly appreciated.